Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. Emily Bazelon is with us now, Slate legal correspondent, panelist on the Slate Political Gab Fest, and author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy. Sticks and Stones is out in paperback now. And believe it or not, in the year since it was first published, the culture of bullying has not been defeated, so there is still plenty to discuss with her. Emily, welcome back to WNYC. Were you hoping that, you know, coming out with your book would just do bullying in the first 6 months?
That would have been great, Brian. But on the other hand, I do feel like the continuing attention to this issue is pretty striking and gratifying.
Absolutely. And you're here for a two-part segment. I'll tell the listeners, so in a bit we'll discuss some of the Supreme Court cases you've got your eye on. But let's talk about bullying. And one of the things that was so great about your book, I thought, was that you provided a clear definition of bullying that clarifies it for many people and that many experts seem to accept. And what makes bullying different from teasing or fighting? So for the millionth time in the last year, want to give us that definition?
Yeah, for sure, because I agree that it's really important and I think helpful to have a limited, narrow definition. Bullying is verbal or physical or social harassment that is repeated over time and involves a power imbalance. So it's not the same thing as a one-off fight. Those can be bad, but they're different. And it's also not the same thing as what a lot of teenagers call drama, which they normally use as a term for a conflict that goes back and forth, in which different kids have power at different moments, and they're really social peers as opposed to one person who is being victimized over time, and really there's a campaign to make that person miserable.
Has anything happened in the last year since the original publication to amend your definition? I know sometimes this happens with authors because of all the feedback they get on a major book. They think, well, yeah, I've actually evolved my thinking a little bit. So anything like that happened to you, particularly with the definition?
Not on the definitional point. I mean, I think the definition I'm talking about is meant to be one that we use in normal language. I'm not saying that it should be the definition that's written into every single state law.
Right.
And I think for schools, right, that which are increasingly under pressure to be handling bullying, which is a good thing, and sometimes disciplining students, which can sometimes go overboard, for schools, they may need a more kind of legalistic language about, abuse of the educational environment, or things that more come from sexual harassment law.
So I want to touch on a report that came out recently. You know what I'm going to say, because you called it the best report on bullying I've ever read. And that was, of all things, the NFL's official report on what happened inside the Miami Dolphins locker room. And to remind people, this is the case of lineman Jonathan Martin, who was repeatedly taunted and abused by teammate Richie Incognito and others. There was a media firestorm a few months ago after Martin quit football, citing the bullying behavior. What's in this official report that surprised you?
It's an incredibly comprehensive investigation of what was going on the offensive line of the Dolphins in terms of the teammates' interactions socially on and off the field. And it really, I think, does an amazing job of showing how a big football player, Jonathan Martin, you know, over 300 pounds, how a guy like that could come to feel really demeaned and degraded and bullied and harassed by his teammates, because they really did, led by Richie Incognito, a few members of the offensive line really did go on a campaign to undermine Jonathan Martin and make him feel like he was dependent on them and worthless. And it really took a toll on him. And you can see that in the evidence collected in this report.
And of course, this is between two adults, though given their behavior, we can hardly call these people adults except in the strictest legal sense. But what makes that different? Or is bullying in the workplace pretty much the same as bullying in a middle school?
What's different, is that we think, and for good reason, that adults should be able to stand up for themselves and be more responsible. We're less worried about them as a category of people needing special attention than with kids. And I think that's right. But I do think that in the workplace where, you know, you're, unless you're going to leave like Martin did, you're captured. You're there in the social environment. And if other people are ganging up on you and really going after you, that's going to have a big effect. And so that's what you can see in this report. It's also a complicated picture because Martin and Incognito had a friendship. They both referred to it as bipolar. And they would spend time one-on-one, which was pretty trusting, intimate time. But then in front of other members of the Dolphins, Incognito would really turn on Martin and kind of use their intimacy against him. And I thought the investigators did just a really good job of getting at that very complicated dynamic.
I think one of the lessons you point to is that in order to really understand the ecosystem of bullying, it requires a lot of investigation. In other words, bullying is a really complicated dynamic. So does that worry you? Does that mean that it's really hard to understand and therefore to prevent?
I think it can seem like a black box. But one thing that is actually great about kids is, and administrators tell me this a lot, if you ask kids a series of questions, most of them will tell you the truth. They'll tell you what happened. And if you have access to text messages and social media content, then you can actually see a trail that people are leaving behind. I think a lot of work has to go into building this. And the tricky part for schools is that with all the demands being placed on them, being responsible for how kids are texting each other or writing to each other on, you know, Snapchat or Instagram, that's a lot to expect of them. So I think that part, we need to recognize that as a burden if we want schools to step in.
Listeners, if you want to talk to Emily Bazelon about her book, Sticks and Stones, about bullying, and it's also about character and empathy, 212-433-WNYC or something from the Richie Incognito, Jonathan Martin NFL report that you might want to bring up in this context, since Emily has looked closely into it and given it the Emily Bazelon seal of approval, 212-433-9692, or to get into some Supreme Court stuff, 212-433-WNYC to talk to Emily Bazelon this morning. One of the things that struck me about the NFL report was that Martin tried virtually everything to push back. At times he ignored it. At times he tried to reach out to his family. At other times he stood up for himself. And that's the old cliche, stand up to a bully and the bully will go away. Well, that didn't seem to work. And other times he sort of tried to suck up to or win his bulliers over and nothing seemed to work. So is it just hopeless if you're being bullied? Does this indicate that the bully actually does get to dictate everything?
Well, that would be a really kind of depressing outcome. I mean, I think for Martin, because he left the team, he just decided he had to make a clean break. And sometimes in extreme situations, that happens with kids in schools too, where they just need to leave and have a fresh start. I do think that Martin, understandably, because of the sort of code in the NFL of never coming forward to report on teammates, he never went to anyone for help up the food chain. And if he had done that, you hope that the Dolphins organization would have tried to deal with this problem, you know, at a higher level. I think in Martin's defense, he saw a couple of coaches who were either participating in bullying or turning a blind eye to it. So I understand why he didn't take that step, but I do think it's really important that the larger message be that if you have a problem, you find someone who you can help and you kind of do problem solving within the context of where you're dealing with the bullying to figure out what to do. But it can be really hard for victims to come up with a good solution. That's something I try to address a lot in my book.
And just to put an even finer point on the complexity of bullying and the relationships involved, the report even characterizes the relationship between Incognito and Martin as a friendship, even at the same time that it was abusive. Do you accept that characterization? Do you think that's possible from your understanding of bullying, that there both be a friendship there and a bullying relationship?
I do. I mean, I think it's a twisted kind of friendship, and that's why they were both talking about it as being bipolar. It had a kind of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde aspect to it. But I think that that's part of human relationships. There often are these kind of complicated dynamics where people are attracted and repelled at the same time. And someone like Incognito, I mean, what struck me about the report was he was really good at manipulating Martin. He kind of had Martin's number. And there were people who were egging him on, so he had the kind of social power. And even though Martin comes from this upper middle class background, his parents are academics, he went to Stanford, in the context of the Dolphins locker room, it was Incognito who really had the power.
And of course, a lot of the taunting of Martin had misogynistic and homophobic overtones. And I'm sure you must have thought about this story in the context of the other big off-the-field NFL story right now, which is that it will soon see its first openly gay player. And there's a debate about whether there's a culture of football as a whole problem here or just particular locker rooms with respect to the bullying. So are there lessons here about how small an ecosystem bullying takes place in? Could you envision an NFL locker room that's supportive, for example, of an out gay player, whereas another one would not be?
Yes, I think we are going to see that locker room, and we're going to see it soon. And I keep thinking about the military. You know, when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the policy of the military and it was illegal to be out as a gay service member, people assumed that if that ever were to change, it would ruin the solidarity and camaraderie of military units. It would damage troop cohesion. There was this whole parade of horribles. But you know what? Now we have out service members, and the military has been doing its own surveys to make sure that's going okay. And the answer is that people have adjusted. And I think that's very much in line with the rapid shift we're seeing in polling numbers about how accepting people are of gay rights generally and gay marriage in particular. And I really think that once the NFL takes this step, it's going to become part of football culture to be inclusive of gay players. It seems unthinkable now, given the rampant homophobia that we've seen from this Dolphins report and from other players like former Vikings player Chris Cluey. But I really think that the NFL is going to make this shift. And I cannot believe that NFL team solidarity has to rely on people in their 20s and 30s talking like really stupid middle schoolers.
Sonny and Parsippany are on WNYC with Emily Bazelon. Hello, Sonny.
Hi, how are you? I just started listening to your show, and I love it.
Thank you.
I've been, you know, just hooked instantly, and I listen to it nonstop.
Thank you so much.
I just wanted to talk about the whole bullying situation. When I was younger, right now I'm 24, and I'm in college at Kane University, and I'm going to become a teacher. But when I was younger, I was harshly bullied as a child, and I don't know if it had anything to do with my race or that I lived in a white neighborhood. But, you know, I came to the point of contemplating my own suicide when I was in the fifth grade, and it was just a very, very depressing, horrible time for me. And I still remember that. And my question is, though, as a future teacher, what can I do to help other students who are going through the same thing?
That's a great question. I'm really glad that you shared your story and then brought up that issue. You know, one really important thing as a teacher is just to be very attuned to the way kids are treating each other and to make sure you're setting a tone in the classroom where kids have to be kind to each other. I really like the mantra, if it's mean, intervene. So in other words, I was talking before about how you have to see a pattern of behavior to know that it's bullying. True, but you don't have to see any kind of pattern to just say to a kid, hey, you need to cut it out. And even if you're wrong and that kid you're reprimanding isn't the bully in the situation, that's okay. You're not suspending that kid. You're just making sure that everyone in the classroom knows that there are ways of talking and kinds of behavior you're just not going to tolerate as the teacher. And I think that really can make a difference. And there's some really good research showing that a classroom dynamic and the way in which the teacher helps enforce a social norm can really matter for kids.
And Sonny, thanks for the question. I'm glad you're a new listener. Thanks for pointing that out. And please keep calling us. But in relation to his question, when you were on the show last year, Emily, you talked about how some schools had set up a bullying log system where kids could record instances of bullying, sometimes anonymously, so that the administrators could get a sense of the patterns. Is that working? Any other efforts you want to highlight, or is that kind of thing working?
I do think that's a good way to go about tracing patterns. You have to do it carefully. I mean, you can't suspend a kid for a bunch of anonymous reports that you haven't substantiated. But if you're trying to get kids to feel like they can trust a guidance counselor, and then they can go in and repeat what's happening without worrying that they're going to be labeled a snitch, that's a really good first step that schools can take. I also think schools can use stories and literature to get kids to start to help them think about not just understanding someone else's feelings, but really valuing them, which is such a key part of empathy. And I've been really encouraged in the last year by some research showing that when you read good, you know, rich stories with people generally, that they then do better on tests of empathy, which involve judging other people's facial expressions and actually having a good sense of what that person is feeling.
Ernst in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Ernst.
Hey, how are you? I listen to you guys whenever I get a chance, whenever I'm driving to school, so thank you for this.
Thank you. What's your question?
Well, what I wanted to say was more or less along the lines of bullying itself. Isn't it something that allows individuals to actually grow? Because, for instance, when I was in high school, I wrestled, played football, and did all those things. And I'm a 24-year-old college student, and I'm of African descent or whatnot. But what I found was that, for me, I wouldn't say I was bullied. I'm only like 5'6", about 140-something pounds. And I did all these things. But what I realized was that whenever something was going on, you know, either that towards an individual who felt as if they were was being taken advantage of, the individual would sometime try to fight it. And if not, there would be people around him who could stand up and do those things. And a lot of times when you go to teachers themselves, the teachers would just like kind of like just, you know, lift their shoulders as if it's, yeah, whatever. So wouldn't bullying actually allow individuals to grow and be strengthened and stop that? Or that's one of my questions.
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, Emily, like whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger kind of thing. Or maybe this just goes to your distinction between bullying and fighting, and what he's talking about is really fighting.
Well, I think that it's true. Adversity does make you stronger if it doesn't kill you. And it can be true about bullying, too. And then the question is, how do you help kids be resilient? One answer to that is that you involve them in the problem solving. So if you're a parent or a teacher and you know a kid is being bullied, instead of, you know, going off in a kind of heroic way to solve the problem for them, what does that kid think should happen next? And what can he or she do to help change things for the better? That's a really good tool to building resilience. And another thing connected to this is some other research that I think is really encouraging. If you give kids pretty simple lessons that show them that the categories of bully and loser can change over time, as your caller is saying, you're not stuck with that forever. You can grow and change. That actually helps kids handle the stress of going into high school, for example, better than kids who didn't receive those lessons. I think there's a really important idea about growth and the whole idea of a growth mindset.
Because there is a fine line. It's not really true that whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, despite, you know, the song and the cliche, because things can really leave you damaged, emotionally damaged for the future.
Yes, that's true. And for some kids who are bullied, that really does happen. I mean, the reason we need to take bullying seriously is that there's a connection between being bullied and rates of depression and anxiety and suicidal thinking. And so there is this vulnerable population here we need to be concerned about. At the same time, we need to hold on to the idea that resilience is really possible and figure out how to channel kids in that direction.
Ernst, thanks for your call. You call us again, too. And by way of segue, because we're going to take a break in a minute, and Emily Bazelon is going to return with her other hat on, her Supreme Court watching hat. But one of the things that we talked about when you were on last year, when the book Sticks and Stones first came out, was that the courts had started to take up the question of bullying, and in particular what happens when bullying takes place online, on Twitter, on Facebook, and then circles back into schools or the workplace for face-to-face bullying. And you characterized it as an unsettled issue of law. Has anything happened in the last year? Have the courts clarified anything?
There are continuing to be cases wrestling with these questions, basically, of when can schools discipline for bullying, and when do kids have free speech rights to write whatever they want online? Do we really want schools policing that whole area of kids' communications? And I think that we're still getting a bunch of court decisions about that. One thing that has changed in the last year, which I'm really interested in, is parents suing other kids and their parents for libel based on what those kids are writing online. So, you know, I think that's actually another important legal tool here, that if your kid is being called names that are libelous, you know, that's another remedy that's available.
Emily Bazelon's book, Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy, is out today in paperback. And fun fact, we have been informally referring to this book as having been out a year ago, and the first interview had been a year ago when the book came out. Turns out it was exactly 1 year ago today, February 20th, 2013. Total coincidence that our first conversation with you about this was exactly this date last year. And actually somebody on Twitter noticed it. So shout out to David on Twitter for knowing every start and end time of every segment on The Brian Lehrer Show ever.
All right.
But Emily is a Slate legal correspondent, panelist on the Slate Gab Fest, and author of Sticks and Stones. And she will be back in a bit for part two of our conversation. We'll switch gears to the Supreme Court, which, come to think of it, kind of meets her definition of bullying, right? Repeated oral arguments with a clear power imbalance. Definitely.
True, true.
So Emily, stick around, and everybody stick around. We continue. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, Emily Bazelon, Slate legal correspondent, is still with us. She's also author of the book about bullying, Sticks and Stones, just out in paperback. But Emily, let's preview some of the Supreme Court cases in the news this coming spring. This isn't going to be the summer of 2013, I don't think, where we saw the court take up affirmative action and voting rights, or even 2012, where it upheld the Affordable Care Act. I read that they're actually taking up about only half the number of cases that they usually do. So is this like momentous decision fatigue on the part of the Supreme Court?
They're not supposed to get that kind of fatigue, but it is a quieter and calmer year. I think there's something cyclical about this. There are just certain cases and issues that bubble up through the lower courts, and then we wait a little while for a new set of super interesting cases to come up. I sort of think next term or the term after that is going to have a lot of really super big cases in it.
Such as?
Well, I think gay marriage is going to come back much sooner than the court anticipated after its pair of rulings last June. I think they thought they had put gay marriage to bed for a while, but it's coming up so quickly in the lower courts that I think that next term we could possibly see a case that head-on asks the Supreme Court to decide whether a state ban of gay marriage is still constitutional.
One case I know you have your eye on for this term on Monday. The court will hear oral arguments in the case of Utility Air Regulatory Group versus Environmental Protection Agency. And sometimes the names of these cases are a little cryptic, but this seems pretty straightforward. Utilities versus the EPA. Why is this case important?
This case raises a question of what kind of power the EPA has to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And what happened was that the EPA started by regulating emissions from cars and trucks. And the Supreme Court has passed on whether that is okay or not. So they're essentially saying, yes, EPA, that's fine. We believe the D.C. Circuit that you have the power to regulate the exhaust coming out of trucks and cars. The question is whether the EPA can then take that same power and apply it to power plants. That's what the industry side of this case is. And so that's the somewhat narrower but still really important question that the Supreme Court will hear next week.
Starting with the 2013 State of the Union and continuing this year, President Obama vowed to take more direct executive action, specifically on environmental issues, among other things, basically conceding that comprehensive climate change policy wasn't going to pass Congress. I know this case has to do with the 2010 regulations, but would it have a political impact on those efforts going forward by the White House?
Yes, I think absolutely, because it's all related, right? This is all about how much power the executive branch, the president and his agencies, have to pass and enforce these regulations on their own without Congress. And there's no question that if Congress had passed cap and trade or gone along with other Obama administration ideas about legislation, then the president and the EPA wouldn't be taking this upon themselves so much. So if the court were to say, you know what, EPA, you went too far here, that would have a kind of dispiriting effect on the president's efforts in this area.
If the EPA prevails here, what does it say about the Obama administration's efforts? In addition to these requirements on facilities, the EPA concluded in 2009 that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases pose a danger to public health. And in 2010, it changed automobile standards. I guess that's the question that that you were referring to a minute ago, that the Supreme Court already weighed in on, because industry was trying to claim that the Clean Air Act didn't regulate greenhouse gases because they weren't pollutants in the sense that we usually think of, you know, the toxic smog and that kind of thing. It's just carbon dioxide. But the Supreme Court said it's okay. The Clean Air Act can be seen as covering that kind of air pollution. So now we have Secretary of State Kerry calling climate change the world's greatest threat. Is this legacy-making stuff for Obama, even without the help of congressional legislation, with the help of the Supreme Court?
I think that it could be. I mean, if the president's regulations are able to really bring down carbon emissions from this country and make a real dent and show that the United States at least has a commitment to lowering this problem worldwide, that will be something he can look back on with pride. And the court, as you've said, has already agreed that greenhouse gases count as air pollutants under the Clean Air Act. And so the other thing, if you worry about climate change, to be grateful here is how broadly the Clean Air Act was written in the 1970s. This is a really far-reaching, far-seeing law that we're still relying on.
All right, let's go to some other rulings that I know you've been tracking, including gay marriage or some other cases. Courts in Ohio and Colorado and California have big same-sex marriage cases this spring. But you and most others, I think, are watching Virginia. Why Virginia?
We're watching Virginia because there is a big district court ruling there last week in which one district court judge struck down Virginia's constitutional ban on gay marriage in its state constitution. And that case is now going to go up to the federal appeals court called the Fourth Circuit, which is the same court that oversees North Carolina and South Carolina and West Virginia and Maryland. And all of those states except for Maryland ban gay marriage. So if the Fourth Circuit agrees with the district court that, okay, it's time for states to stop restricting gay marriage, there's just no rational reason to prevent same-sex couples from getting married, that would be a real sea change in those southern states. And that's when you start to wonder, okay, are we then going to see the Supreme Court step in here on a national level? And what will happen if the Supreme Court takes one of these cases?
One of the elements in the Virginia case is that judges appointed by Democratic presidents have a 10-5 edge over Republicans on the Richmond-based 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. This used to be among the nation's most conservative appeals courts. Is this Obama's doing, shifting the makeup of that and other circuit courts?
It's so interesting that you raise that, because Obama has been pummeled by liberals for years for not doing enough to fill these circuit court appointments. But we saw the administration and the Senate finally challenge the traditional rules of filibuster that have made it easier for the Republicans to block Obama candidates, nominees, to these appeals court positions. And now you're starting to see these appointments really come in, not just in the Fourth Circuit, but across the country. The vacancies are getting filled. I mean, this is just how we fill vacancies, right? If you're the president, you generally get to pick the judges. When it's the other party's turn in power, they get to pick the judges. So what we're seeing here is normal democracy. But because so many appointments were blocked for a long time, it's going to feel like a larger number suddenly are getting filled.
Did the Virginia court use last year's Supreme Court decision on gay marriage as a precedent, or were they going to support gay marriage anyway, given the political orientation of the judges?
The Virginia court right now, where we just have this one district court ruling, heavily relied on the Supreme Court's ruling last year in Windsor, which was the case out of New York that struck down the Defense of Marriage Act. And what's so interesting to me is that in the Supreme Court decision last June, there were kind of two pillars. There was equality and dignity and the rights of gay people. Justice Kennedy, who wrote that decision, talked in important, you know, real strong language about all of those things. But he also talked about the state power and authority over the domain of marriage. And in some ways, in these cases about state marriage bans, those two principles are in tension, right? Because you could argue that, well, Virginia should get to make its own rules about marriage. But all the district court judges who've ruled so far have picked up on a dignity and equality argument from Justice Kennedy and really set to the side the idea of state authority. And so that is just a fascinating reading of Justice Kennedy. And the question is that what he really meant to be saying?
Are there other Supreme Court cases on gay marriage in the future, or is this all going to shake out at the state level now?
I think the Supreme Court eventually will take one of these cases because as they start to bubble up, I mean, there are challenges all over the country. And there are going to be some judges who read Justice Kennedy the opposite way and say, yes, states can still ban gay marriage. And then presumably you'll have a conflict among the lower courts. And that's when the Supreme Court tends to step in.
All right. One more before we run out of time. Still to come, I guess, this spring, the so-called Hobby Lobby case. This is the objection on the part of a company to the provisions in the Affordable Care Act that require insurers to provide contraception coverage. Hobby Lobby, which is a retail chain of arts and craft stores based in Oklahoma City, says that the ACA forces them to provide services to which they morally object. But Emily, this is a store. This is not a religious institution like a church with explicit First Amendment rights. How do you see this shaking out?
Well, because it's a store, the big question is whether it can claim personhood, a legal construct, for in order to claim protection that it can't it's exercising its religious freedom. So in other words, Congress passed a law in 2000 protecting the religious freedom of persons. Does Hobby Lobby get to say, you know what, we have a religious objection to this contraception mandate and we count under that law. So Congress, you went too far here. And that would really extend the definition of legal personhood beyond the campaign finance realm that we're familiar with in Citizens United to this idea of religious rights.
And what about the legal personhood of the individual woman employee who doesn't want her employer to deny what might be seen as her religious rights to be protected by the Affordable Care Act because of somebody else's religion?
Right. To me, this is the winning side of the argument, because even if you have a burden on religious rights, according to this congressional law, the government can still step in if it has a compelling reason to make a rule or a law. And in this case, the government had really clear evidence that access to contraception helps improve women's health. And so to me, that's the government's trump card here.
And I see another paradox here for religious conservatives, because tell me if I'm wrong, but I think religious conservative judges or judges that tend to side with the religious conservative arguments on things have actually ruled in the past that the distinction matters. That is, if the justification for some religiously oriented schools that receive federal money for textbooks is that the federal government isn't promoting religion, it's simply administering a network that includes some religious schools. On that basis, they can get tax money for a religious institution. So would conservative judges be arguing against their own precedent here if they uphold Hobby Lobby?
That's a really interesting hypothetical. I mean, I think what you're talking about is the tension between free exercise of religion and the separation of church and state, right? The idea that you don't want the government in the business of promoting a particular religious viewpoint. And I'm not really sure how that would play out in this case, although I'm sure the conservative judges who, if they want to find for Hobby Lobby, will find some way to kind of separate and distinguish those two lines of cases.
Right, because the argument, and it's good that you point that out. I think people forget sometimes that the religion clause of the First Amendment has those two parts. I think depending on people's politics sometimes or their religion, they tend to emphasize one or the other, that the government shall not establish religion, right? At the same time, every person has an individual freedom of religion to worship as they so choose. So, I don't know, in a way, sometimes even though they seem consistent, they can get in the way of each other.
Right. They can definitely conflict. I mean, for example, here, if the government were to say women cannot have contraception because there are some Christians who disagree with that viewpoint, and this is the opposite, obviously. But if the government did say that, then we would be really worried about it. The Establishment Clause problem here, that the government was promoting Christianity. So it's different for Hobby Lobby to assert this right than for the government to legislate based on that idea.
And the argument on the part of the defendants is that Hobby Lobby isn't providing contraception or fertility treatments. It's simply providing an insurance plan that gives a full range of legal health benefits. So we'll see how all those arguments – I should say that's another argument of the defendants. So we will see how all those arguments mix into a Supreme Court ruling, I guess, by the end of June. Any that I've missed before we're out of time?
That's a really good roundup. I mean, I'm really looking forward to this Hobby Lobby case myself. I think it's just going to be such an interesting one for the court to grapple with.
Have you ever been to a Hobby Lobby? Where do you shop for your arts and crafts?
I'm so not an arts and crafts person. I have like a hole in my brain where that's supposed to go. So no, I've never been to one.
I don't think there's a Upper Manhattan or Queens Hobby Lobby that I know of, right?
Right. There's also a Mennonite woodworking store called Conestoga Wood that is involved in this case. Uh-huh. And I have seen some of their woodworking, and it's quite lovely.
I do think there's a Hobby Lobby in New Jersey. So I think they are actually represented in our area. All right. Emily Bazelon, Slate legal correspondent, panelist on the Slate Political Gab Fest, which you can hear weekends on WNYC, and author of Sticks and Stones, Defeating the Culture of Bullying and Rediscovering the Power of Character and Empathy, just out in paperback. Great conversations about bullying and the Supreme Court. Emily, thanks as always.
Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, how do you survive financially if you're training for the Olympics? If you're not one of those big Olympic athletes who gets all the endorsements, how do you actually support yourself as an Olympic athlete? We'll try to find out. Stay tuned.